Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live the good life and create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social conscious and unconscious dynamics and desires. Edgy Ideas is proudly sponsored by the Eco Leadership Institute. We offer coach and leadership training courses, and we have a vibrant community of practice where international members join once a month for a webinar. Our focus is on co-creating the good society. To find out more, go to www.ecoleadershipinstitute.org, and to read my polemic blogs and essays, go to Simon Western at Substack. Thank you for listening. So welcome to this edition of Edgy Ideas podcast. Today, my special guest is Neil O'Doherty. Neil is a professor of political science and sociology, and he's a director of the MA in public policy at the University of Galway. Neil's published extensively on Northern Ireland and on the conflict and on peace negotiations, and more widely on territorial conflict. His most recent book is Deniable Contact: Back Channel Negotiation in Northern Ireland, and it was awarded the Brian Farrell Book Prize for Political Studies on the Association of Ireland. Neil, very good to meet you. How are you doing today?
Doing well, and thank you for the invitation, Simon. I'm looking forward to the opportunity to have an open-ended kind of conversation.
Yeah, it's good. And it's funny because nearly all my guests are from all over the world, and you're about 2 miles away from me. So I'm in Salt Hill, Galway, and you're in Galway University.
Yeah, no, that's close, but so far.
That's right. Hugely interested in, I followed the conflict in Northern Ireland all my adult life, close and far. You've been studying it. Where would you want to begin with your latest book? It sounds a very interesting bit, looking behind the scenes of the peace process.
Yeah, what I'm most proud of in the book is that my own understanding of the conflict developed and changed as I carried out the research, and even as I wrote the book, because I was rethinking things. I would write paragraphs and then I would rewrite them later as I changed my mind. And I feel it makes a genuinely original contribution, not just to understanding back channel negotiation, but to understanding the conflict in Northern Ireland in a new light, and sort of provoking us to revisit some of the assumptions that we have.
Yeah, and I look forward to reading your book. I haven't managed to get to it yet. I'm really looking forward to it, because I had a connection with one of your key actors, which is Brendan Duddy. He's someone's whose paper you've researched a lot. Is that right?
That's right. And those papers of his, and he was the key intermediary between the British government and the IRA leadership on a number of key occasions between the early 1970s and the early 1990s. His papers are crucial, and the interviews I conducted with him over a period of several years, but they're important not only in their own right, but because they unlock the other sources. They cast fresh light on the state papers and on the accounts that Republicans have provided. I mean, and they're just, some of his materials are extraordinary. Now, I've written a book and I've written a number of articles drawing on his papers, but there is a huge amount yet to be said and written about that archive of his.
Really? So just for the listeners, because you and I kind of know a bit more about the inside story, for those who don't know, Brendan was running a fish and chip shop in Derry. And he was having negotiations behind the scenes. Do you want to say a bit more about that, Neil?
Yeah, well, I should say initially that he came from a working class background where they were quite deprived in material terms, but he had a huge interest in politics from quite an early age. And he went to grammar school, which was, he went to school that was dominated by middle class kids. He felt very much his working class identity there. But he maintained his interest in politics throughout. So he's sometimes described as his fish and shop owner, but he's a political animal and a political individual before he ever starts in business. And the business he starts up, it's a sign of his kind of the strength of character, or, you know, he's tough-minded. He could be a tough individual to deal with, but he has this incredible drive. So that's the first important thing about him. And as the conflict begins, he owns a fish and chip shop, but it's a fish and chip shop where the leaders of the civil rights movement gather to plan their marches. And he's part of that. He's the alternate for one of the leaders of one of the big early civil rights marches in Derry, so that if the leader is arrested, Brendan Duddy will stand in his place on the day. So he's very strongly connected to these people. He's talking to them all the time. So he's immersed in the local political environment. And that's crucially important. And he is looking for a way to exert influence. And there is something about the individual, the importance of the individual here. So he said to me on a few occasions, you have to forget about your ego. But at this, and that's true in many ways, he did that. He sort of put aside the ego in order to progress the process. At the same time, the whole thing is driven by his wish as an individual to make an impact. So he does want to be a person who does something and changes something. And in the early 70s, he identifies this intersection between the IRA and the British government as the most effective place to intervene. Mm-hmm. And in that, I think there's a political understanding there and a political analysis that I think is correct at the beginning. It says this is the place. Yeah. These are the two key actors, the British state and the IRA leadership. He's absolutely right in that. He gets plenty of things wrong, but he has this understanding of kind of the overall strategic picture.
Yeah, yeah. So just for those who don't know, Brendan Duddy was also part of the group relations tradition in the UK, which is a way of studying experiential learning, experiential groups, trying to understand crossing boundaries, holding onto boundaries, holding roles, holding tasks. And his mentor, I believe, was Gordon Lawrence, one of our leading thinkers in this field. And you can see how that kind of supports his thinking during this negotiations about identifying key actors and holding on to his role when he, I mean, to step out of role was inviting real trouble and even death, wasn't it?
Yes. And it's clear he came close to death on a number of occasions. And, it's been confirmed by the former leader of the Belfast IRA that in the mid-1970s, they discussed whether to kill him or not, because he had written a letter to the British Prime Minister of the time, Harold Wilson, in the name of the IRA's chief strategist of the time, David O'Connell or Dahi O'Connell. And they did consider whether they should kill him or not. So there's great danger. The Tavistock learning is really interesting. I write a little bit about it in the book, but I'm actually continuing to do research on this aspect of his work. So I just touch on it very briefly in the book. But he talks about, in interviews with me, he described the first Tavistock-related event he went to in Dublin. I think it was in Trinity College, Dublin. And it was organized by an Irish psychiatrist who was based, Ivor Brown, based mm-hmm. in Dublin, with the involvement of Gareth O'Connor, who is based in California, a very prominent psychiatrist in the United States. They had asked if they could use the Tavistock name and run it under Tavistock auspices. That was around 1975. And in his interview with me, he described that as an absolutely traumatizing, chaotic event that infuriated him. And he said he felt that they hadn't run it strictly according to the Tavistock guidelines, that they had overdone certain aspects of it. So, for example, they brought the people together and then they refused to explain at all, at any stage, what the purpose of the thing was, leaving people furious. But he talked as well about how they'd invited, civil servants, clergy, IRA members at a time when IRA campaigns were underway. So I'm interested in learning more about these things, but certainly he saw these events and he then became involved in the Tavistock Conference in Leicester in subsequent years. He saw these as very important in giving him an insight into group dynamics. But I think as well as the insights they offered, he values the credentials. You know, he wants to be associated with some school of thought. He wants some kind of sanction or authority, or to say that, you know, this is my method. So I think there's a mix of things there, that lots of what he does comes from his kind, the understanding that he's built up over his lifetime of the political dynamics, some of it from the Tavistock experience, but also Tavistock is there as a kind of credential and a source of authority and support.
And I was really interested in what you said before. I mean, I'm a leadership scholar, and we talk about leadership. Often leadership gets people talk about individual leaders and leadership, collective leadership bodies and stuff. This idea of kind of letting go of your ego, but also being ego driven, I think is very interesting, because clearly Brendan is a good example of someone who is very forceful, very driven, quite charismatic when he spoke, but also, like I say, able to let that go at the same time. It's a very interesting balance, and often the leadership literature kind of confuses this, and it says, "Oh, we should just be servant leaders and let go of our ego," and yet we also know that leaders need this strength, this drive, this kind of this ego as well. So I think your description is very, very useful, actually.
Well, drive and vision. A kind of an analysis that powers them on, that they have an understanding that motivates them and kind of justifies the position they're taking.
So moving into your book a bit more, you say you learnt along the way and you uncovered some thinking which you think is new to yourself and to others. Do you want to share some of that?
Well, one thing that was new to me was the extent to which the leadership of the IRA, or the leadership of the Republican movement encompassing the IRA and Sinn Féin, were open to difficult compromise from a relatively early stage, from the early 1970s. And one might say, well, there was no compromise they were open to that the British government could actually implement. I think that's something to be sort of explored empirically. But there's certainly an orientation from a very, very early stage to compromise. They know they are not going to get something that will make their followers happy. There's going to be people peeling off. There are going to be people accusing them of treachery. And they're orienting themselves to this kind of settlement from a pretty early stage. I would say that the dominant view in the literature is that, you know, they went hell for leather for 25 years for their United Ireland. They weren't going to settle for anything else. They were ideologically driven fanatics. And finally, they realized they couldn't win and they simply had to give up. So I think it's clear to me from the research that the kind of settlement they went into in the 1990s was not that they would have accepted that kind of settlement 25 years ago, but certain aspects of it that their own people would be deeply disappointed, that they would have to perhaps give up on the idea of United. I think as early as 1971, 1972, they're thinking we might have to sign up to a settlement that doesn't involve the United Ireland, but they're looking to get something that they can present as a victory. So that's one thing. You know, I came to see the extent to which their uncompromising rhetoric was necessary in order to hold their people behind them, to prevent competing groups from attracting their followers, to prevent accusations of treachery. The extent to which that sort of hardline rhetoric, which they used for partly for internal purposes, could be used against them by opponents saying, well, you know, believe them when they say they will settle for nothing less than this, you know, that's, and therefore the opponents can say, there's no point talking to these people. There's no point considering what a compromise might look like because they're just fanatics.
Yeah. Can I ask you about the violence? We have some very political people thinking in the Republican and on the union side. We have some very good analysis people, very thoughtful people, and we have some absolutely brutal violence happening. What kind of sense do you make of that from being like quite close to it?
Yeah, and so there is a sense at the very beginning that things can be, you can have a violent campaign that is in some way clean.
Mm-hmm.
And so I came across this report in the local paper in Derry, on one of the first occasions in which the IRA injures a civilian while they're shooting a British soldier, and it happens to be a young Protestant girl, so from the other the community that's absolutely not supportive of the IRA and completely opposed, and they send flowers to the hospital where this girl is, and it's kind of a fantasy that we mm-hmm. might be able to have the kind of war where, or the kind of armed campaign where, you know, occasionally we'll make minor mistakes, we'll send flowers, we'll apologize, but people understand that we're basically, you know, good people.
Yeah.
And as time goes on, the movement becomes associated with more and more horrific violence, is responsible for more and more horrific violence. Some of it that takes place because of incompetence or recklessness. But as time goes on, those things accumulate, and it
yes.
becomes more and more difficult for opponents to argue for compromise. I just want to point out one thing that's significant. I mean, the IRA are known for these bombings in England that killed large numbers of civilians in Birmingham in 1974 and Guildford and elsewhere. You know, they didn't launch a bombing campaign in England until they were something like 3 years into their campaign. So if they had ended all of this much earlier, there would be much less, you know, they would look much less violent and bloody and reckless. And I think that's a huge, I think they're not unaware of the horror of violence. And I think the leadership in the early 1970s is motivated partly by a wish to end the violence.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they don't want to do that at the cost of being defeated or at the cost of their movement being destroyed. But I think among the things that they consider the end of violence as something that has some value in its own right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, do you have any thoughts coming from England, having grown up throughout the conflict? What are your thoughts on the nature of that violence and the effects of that violence?
It's quite difficult. I mean, I was a young man. I visited Ireland when I was 21 years old, and I came to the south to Limerick, and I visited ever since. I became attached to Ireland, and I'd be in the pubs, and the IRA newspaper would be handed around, and it'd be collecting for the IRA, and it was like, you know, I got kind of very intrigued, and I started reading their materials as well, and realizing how different what they were saying was reported in the British media. I actually went up to Belfast very foolishly as a young man, probably 23 or 24 years old, and I thought I'd go and find out for myself, which was not a very wise thing to do, being an English accent, walking down the Falls Road, and then I visited Derry. I remember being on the Falls Road, and I remember the brutality of just watching every 30, 40 seconds, there'd be an armoured vehicle going up it, there'd be soldiers at the back jumping out, running up to men, pushing them up against the wall, throwing apple cores at women. It was like the feeling of tension and violence there was like something else. And I had to get out quick. I someone heard my accent, like some woman started swearing blind at me, and I had to kind of make a quick exit. And and then I went to Derry, and I saw the burning vehicles, and I remember I walked into a pub, and I said, "Is there a bed and breakfast around here?" And they looked at me, And the whole place kind of first thought, you know, is this guy dangerous? And then second kind of thought, no, he's just stupid. And they just cracked up laughing. They said there's not much call for B&Bs in Derry at the moment. And then they were really kind, and they sent me to a neighbor's house who had a spare room because her son was at university, and they, you know, this great generosity, you know. So that was like my experience. But I mean, the violence was shocking. Like when the innocents, you know, I mean, there's this idea of a clean war and legitimate targets, you know, and that was always quite distressing because it's still young men, young women getting killed, you know. But then there's the, you know, the bombing, and when they're killing people in pubs, you know, even there are, you know, Irish people, English people, kind of almost indiscriminately, this kind of violence. And also being aware that violence is not one-sided, you know. I was very aware, which people around me in England weren't aware, that, you know, there's violence from the other side as well, from the British Army, from the Unionist side, you know, some pretty horrible things happening as well, and you didn't get told that part of the story in England at the time. But still, in myself, still now, is, you know, it's like watching the Israeli kind of Hamas violence, you know, that brutality of violence still shocks me. And it didn't, you know, when I came across IRA violence and violence in Northern Ireland, and it does now still, like, you know, this violence, which is, yeah, almost, it's not violence for violence sake, but it's like beyond my understanding, I guess.
I think, you know, one thing that happens is as violence begins to escalate, you know, many people pick a side and then find themselves implicated in escalating violence. Now, obviously, there are many people enthusiastic and quite happy to support high levels of violence, but there are others who find themselves involved in a movement, doing things that they hadn't envisaged doing. And partly they're committed to that movement. That's the side they're on. And they can always point to the other side and say, you know, well, they are doing terrible things are being done to us. And of course, the period you're talking about when you were in Belfast and Derry, it's the early 1970s, the violence is absolutely chaotic, large scale. Mm-hmm. And in the working class Catholic areas of the cities where the IRA gathers support, the provisional IRA, also the official IRA, you know, large numbers of people are being killed by loyalists, but also, especially in 71 and 72, by British troops. And there's a sense that although the British state presents itself as a neutral arbiter, in those areas, it looks like they're simultaneously under assault by the British state and loyalists side by side, even if the British state makes some attempts to control loyalists.
Yeah. And I imagine, you know, studying the group relations as Brendan did and being part of that and just studying group behavior over many, many years, you know, once you are caught up in something and when there's a group pressure and then there's a real fear that if you don't do it, you have to kind of do what you're told in an army situation, in an armed situation. There's a fear, there's a collective, and the human capacity for denial, like for creating the good self, you know, we're fighting the righteous fight and the others are the evil ones is phenomenal, the way we can rationalize our behaviors.
Yeah, and a student asked me recently in a class, I teach a class on the Northern Ireland conflict, about, you know, how could people support an organization like the IRA that killed large numbers of civilians in bombings. And so it made me think of exactly why. I mean, one reason was certain attacks were denied. And in truth, these, you know, like the Birmingham bombing was, I don't think has ever been officially accepted by the IRA. In truth, the IRA leadership did not seek a bomb that killed a large number of civilians in a pub. And, you know, lots of things happened that did not happen in the fulfillment of the leadership's wishes, happened for all sorts of reasons.
Yes.
That weren't about an overall strategy or a plan. But how denial is one thing. The other thing is accidents, mistakes. And this is how conventional armies also justify themselves or collateral damage. You know, sometimes civilians are going to suffer, and that's just the way it is in a war. So many of the justifications are familiar from the way in which the violence by states is legitimized. But much more difficult to do that when you don't have a media that supports you or backs you. Mm-hmm. And so it's harder to maintain that, you know, legitimacy among your supporters and your support base.
Yeah. And through your work, you must have come across your John Humes and your Brendan Dudders and people who didn't choose that path. Can you say something about that? People who kind of were absolutely convicted that that was the wrong path, that the violent path.
You mean the path of seeking a peace settlement?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, some people really put their courageous selves on the line to fight, to stand for peace against violence. And I wonder kind of what your thoughts are about them.
Yeah, well, it's interestingly complex. And so Brendan Duddy, who I think played a very positive role mm-hmm. in drawing together the positions of the British state and the Republican leadership in the 1990s and attempting to do that at an earlier stage, was regarded by some who knew what he was doing as complicit with the IRA. Anybody who sought to include them. And so, and in fact, John Hume was condemned for the same reasons, that any attempt to bring the Republicans in was immoral.
Mm-hmm.
And so when it eventually succeeded, you know, a consensus emerged to support this kind of work in retrospect to say, yes, it was justified. And at the time, Brendan Duddy and John Hume were both fully supported by the British state, and the British state was absolutely sort of behind what they were doing. And figures like John Chilcot, the permanent undersecretary in the Northern Ireland office, liaising very closely with John Hume. So you have this paradox where opponents of violence within the broader Irish nationalist community are harshly condemning people like John Hume for talking to the men of violence or the people of violence, and would have condemned Brendan Duddy if they'd known of his existence. And yet the British government, which is directly fighting this struggle against the IRA, is saying, yeah, good idea. Yeah, that's what we need. We need a pragmatic settlement here. So you know, that kind of the purity of people who said, no, you mustn't deal in any way with this people. That was not a purity that the British government, for the British government, the messy compromise was a better route than the pure eternal yeah. conflict that they would have to wage and pay for. And so I'm skeptical of those sort of very pure kind mm-hmm. of pro-peace, you know, there are men of violence and they are tainted and mustn't be touched. But for someone like Brendan Duddy, it was really difficult. I mean, he said this, you know, there's a lot in the interviews I did with him that I haven't used in the book. And one of the things I didn't use that he said to me was, you know, there was no toleration for the kind of thing I was doing. No toleration in the public sphere. This was basically, you know, fellow traveler, complicity, all of that. And yet it's something that the British government wanted because it could see, you know, and I'm sorry, I should say he wasn't, you know, it wasn't an act of complicity. It wasn't an act of fellow traveling. It was an analysis that said a peace settlement requires this major political force yeah. to weigh in behind it.
Yeah. Yeah, I invited Brendan to a conference. I was working at the Tavistock in London for a bit, and whilst there, I had a faith in leadership conference, and we were playing with the idea that all leadership needs some kind of faith, and for some that will be a religious or spiritual faith, and for others that will be just a faith in humanity. And Brendan came and did a turn, and I talked to him, and he, you know, he was very charismatic. It was after his BBC secret peacemaker program. He'd gone public by then, and he said to me that he used to walk the hills behind Derry, and that was his great source of faith, that he would kind of draw on this kind of this, like I said, this great inner strength from somewhere. And he didn't kind of specifically describe it, but just said, you know, to kind of replenish himself and to find that great inner strength to kind of hold himself through what must have been a very anxiety-provoking time. I mean, the situations he found himself in and during that kind of long period, to manage yourself is quite something, isn't it?
Yeah, no, I think the pressure was crushing at times.
Mm.
And he, in one of his diary entries in 1975, during a ceasefire that eventually broke down, he writes, I'm working in a coal seam. That sense of having almost no room to move or maneuver, and that sense almost of being trapped is there. In terms of faith, I mean, he talked to me about sort of when he would travel to meet Sinn Féin President Rory O'Brody, as he often did in the 1970s, that he would always try to call into a church, whether it was Catholic or Protestant, didn't matter to him. And he would call into these little country churches just to get some comfort. And certain members of the clergy, individual clerics, were supportive of him. And he found huge kind of solace in that and support there. So, you know, the sort of spiritual dimension, although it wasn't completely conventional Catholic, was certainly important to him. But the difficulty, I mean, I sometimes say when I talk about the topic that, you know, the one thing I learned was don't be a mediator, you know, in a situation like this, where it's almost impossible.
Mm.
You know, he's for 25 years, he intermittently plays this role and it almost never succeeds. You know, it's just a litany of failures until eventually there's a breakthrough. And just the extraordinary difficulty, the suspicion that's aroused on both sides. And there's a lovely line, again, from one of the interviews that I didn't include in the book. He's picked up at Heathrow and he's being brought to see some British government official. And the guy driving the car, who presumably is an intelligence officer, turns around at some stage, maybe when they're stopped in traffic, and says, "Just who do you work for anyway?" And, you know, clearly the implication being, are you an IRA? You know, are you working for the IRA? Are you an IRA emissary? To what extent is an intermediary? And of course, on the other side, he was the face of the British state.
Yes.
Both sides, he looks like the face of the other. It's very, you know, difficult.
Very difficult. Hard to imagine even. Hard to imagine. In your book, Neil, am I right? I mean, there's some very famous... The peace process was quite incredible because a constellation of actors came together and Momola and all these famous names, Tony Blair, all the big names, you know, that the Americans came across on force, and there was quite an amazing effort. But in your book, are you saying that there's also a missing story about the underground kind of activities which were happening? Is that what you're pointing to as well? A bit?
Well, a prerequisite for all of that is an end to the IRA campaign.
Yeah.
And that's clearly understood that afterwards, in the absence, if you have a clear end to the IRA campaign and a path towards the eventual disarmament and disbandment of the IRA, that you are then in a position to build an inclusive settlement of some kind. While that campaign is ongoing and enjoys substantial support and has a support base, it's extraordinarily difficult to build a settlement, and that settlement may be unstable. So it opens the way. So now that's understood, I think, by everybody in the 1990s, that the foundation is an end to the IRA campaign has some kind of finality about it because the Republican leadership is behind it, is delivering it, and is in favor of it. So that has to be ending the IRA campaign, and this is one of Brendan Duddy's insights as an intermediary, has to be coordinated with the British state. The IRA, as Duddy says in one of his diary entries way back in 1975, he says the IRA needs a victory in order to end their need to fight the British. He's saying basically they need visible gains in order to successfully call it off in a way that will convince the great majority of those involved to stand down and row in behind the leadership. You won't get everybody, but you know, the worst thing would be to call it off like the official IRA did in 1972 and then just to lose everybody.
Yeah.
So, you know, the result of that you know, if you call it off, but all of your followers leave and join an organization that will continue, you know, you haven't contributed to the ending of the conflict.
No.
And that requires the British government as a central power player. And that's sort of one of the things that became firmly embedded in my mind over the years was, well, it's a very simple insight, really. The British government is a central power player here. They're the ones with the resources. They're the ones with the coercive capacity. They are constrained, of course, by unionists. They're constrained to a certain extent by nationalists and by the Irish state and by actors beyond that. Nonetheless, nobody else has the power and resources that they have in this situation. And so they're crucial. So they have to come in behind the idea of a settlement that involves enough compromise that the Republican leadership can successfully stand down their, end their campaign in a way that convinces the great majority of their supporters to follow them.
Yeah. And of course, Neil, on everyone's minds is our other conflicts. We have in our sphere, Russia, Ukraine, and of course, Israel and Palestine. I'm sure you're asked a lot about these. What's the translation of any learnings you've got to these others? What's your thoughts on it? I'm sure you're asked a lot.
Yeah, well, the first thing is there are no easy, simple, you know, easily transferable lessons. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I'm really hesitant to, you know, offer prescriptions or advice. Yeah. And I think everybody should be really hesitant to say, oh, these are the lessons of the Irish peace process. I think some insights are relevant, but these are insights in what that one can glean from other situations of conflict as well. For me, one of the important insights is that, you know, the rhetoric of militant non-state groups does not necessarily provide an accurate guide to the settlement they might ultimately be prepared to accept. That's one thing. And their militant rhetoric, which has all sorts of functions, you know, keeping the troops motivated, ensuring they don't defect to more other militant groups, and that it can be used by their opponents to say, well, there's no way we can compromise with these people. So it provides a kind of alibi. The other thing, other insight, and again, it's an insight that can be gleaned from many other situations, is the importance of internal conflict. I mean, many things that both states and armed groups do are the outcome not of some unified will, but of an internal struggle, which has all sorts of logics of its own that have very little to do, or, you know, are almost detached from the relationship with the opponent. And again, there's a lovely phrase that comes from Brendan Duddy's 1975 diary: the British make a concession, but it's so attenuated that he says this is going to do absolutely no use. And he says, the problem is anything the British do, by the time it goes down the corridor and every door opens and each department takes its slice in turn, there's nothing left. So he has this idea that things are going on internally within the British state where everybody is bargaining with one another in the process of bargaining across the divide, that, you know, they're deeply constrained and internal struggles are shaping their engagement across the divide. So those are a couple of thoughts. Just a few scattered thoughts.
No, that's very helpful. And I think you're wise to say there's no transferable lessons. I know that the Irish peace process is something rolled out as a something you can take throughout the world, but every local and contextual kind of situation has its own things particular to it, doesn't it? And we have to kind of hold that in mind, I think.
Yeah. I mean, the one other insight I would mention is the central power player or players are crucial. What they want and what they're willing to do, the most powerful actors involved. That's absolutely central. And And if they do not want, if they prefer to overwhelm the opponent, you know, there's very little that can be done by way of persuasion or negotiation if that is their firm fixed preference, and they don't see the value in compromise. I wanted to, I mean, you may have another question now, Simon, but before we go, I definitely do want to ask you a bit more about Tavistock and the Tavistock approach. But perhaps you have something else you'd like to talk about before that.
I got a lot, I find this conversation fascinating, so I've got lots to ask, but we're running out of time. And the Tavistock approach, I mean, I smiled when you said that you think it might have been not done quite correctly because people just sit there and won't answer a question. That is one of the classic features of the Tavistock approach. So the Tavistock Institute in the kind of started this way of trying to learn from experience, and it's it drew on a number of different theoretical kind of backgrounds, psychoanalysis being one of them, systems thinking, trying to understand how groups operate, and it takes you away from just individual understanding of dynamics and thinks about kind of group as a whole dynamics. So there's a whole kind of idea they have scholars like Wilfred Bion who talks about the unconscious process in groups and how groups can gather together around certain unconscious ideas which hold them together. And they explore this in like large groups and small groups, and it's all experiential. And their famous Leicester conference is something which goes on for nearly 2 weeks, and you're going from small group to a large group, and there's very little structure. So you study your here and now process, what happens to you in here and now, and it's very, very powerful learning. I've just actually come back from Poland. I've just been working with humanitarians from Ukraine and Poland. 60 humanitarians came together and working alongside Save the Children using some of this methodology. So we draw on that methodology. So it's experiential learning, learning from each other, learning from experience, and trying to analyze what happens to you actually in group situations. And you know, a large focus in the past and still is around kind of clear boundaries, clear roles, how you cross boundaries in groups, how you become identified with a group, strong identifications with groups, strong sense of belonging with groups. And this happens in these experimental settings. This happens very quickly. It's almost shocking. I just run this kind of I call it the leadership game, and we put people in groups. They're together for 3 hours, and after that 3 hours, they're bonded to that group. They don't want to let go of that group. So in the next event, they hang together with that group. It's quite amazing the human capacity for sort of belonging and identifying with a group, whatever it is. So it just explores all those kind of dynamics, and it's a way of doing it. And I can really see how that would have been very helpful to Brendan as he was navigating his way through, you know, not the only thing, I'm sure there's lots of other things, but as one place to kind of try and clarify his thinking. And I can imagine it really helps to get that clarity of saying, okay, these two groups need to come together, that these are the key actors. I can see, and how he would manage to hold his role of being this mediator between, you know, being seduced, pulled too much in one way, too much in another way, finding his kind of his space. I can see how this would have helped his understanding of his position and given him somewhere to explore playing with some of those ideas.
Yeah, I can see the value of it, and the idea of boundary was very important to him, the boundaries of the role. And I have a follow-up question, which is, you know, what would you say to the person who said, give me the 10-page Tavistock guide to group relations and boundaries so I don't have to go through these 2 weeks of experiential learning? What's the power and value of the... And I'm being devil's advocate here because I can imagine the power of that. But what would you say to the person who said, look, just give me the 10-pager. I don't have 2 weeks, but, you know, I'll read it and then I'll understand how groups work.
Simply, you can. I mean, you can get certain types of things from cognitive knowledge and cognitive understandings, but your body carries experiences, and the unconscious we carry in our bodies. It's surprised how these were evoked in living situations, you know. I mean, apart from these high conflict situations, you work in a university, you know the politics and the dynamics of a university, and all the, you know, the things which go on in any large institution. And these are things you actually feel in your body and you experience them. So you there's some things you can learn from reading books, and there's some things you can't. And this is one thing you can't. So to really understand how you're, and our unconscious attachments and investments, they come from quite a young age, really. Often they're formed, you know, we have formation experiences when we're infants and as we grow up, depending on the culture you grow up in. Like, I mean, you mentioned that Brendan was working class, and then he went to his grammar school, and he felt his isolation there for being working class. And so we carry these experiences, and they help form who we are. And the Tavistock kind of type of learning allows us to kind of experience those feelings again and make some sense of them. But you don't get that just from reading. I mean, you can get some from reading, you know, you can start getting some insights, but an experiential learning is very much more kind of about awakening an unconscious and bodily experience, as well as just a cognitive thinking one.
Yeah, that's a great explanation. And I am convinced. I, for one, am convinced. Quick follow-up question about spatial. Do you notice spatial dimensions to these group relations? I mean, this is personal interest. For a long time, I taught a course on conflict and territory, and I begin with personal boundaries and where people choose to sit in a room. Yeah. And I'm just wondering if that is something you've ever, having done this for many years, something you've ever noticed.
I mean, I came back from this event empowered in 3 days of experiential learning, and the whole thing is designed around space. How do we set up the chairs in the beginning? So I set up myself as director and the management team facing the participants. And then we move to kind of a large circle, and then we move to a large configuration of chairs where they're really messed up in the room. And we're trying to get people to free associate and disrupt their kind of thinking. So we think about space an awful lot and how we move between spaces. It's a huge part of this. And I think space is really important to this work, and often not thought about enough.
Yeah. Well, that's really interesting. That's great. Yeah.
So we'll grab a coffee later in the month, and we'll talk more. Neil, I ask guests one last question. I'd forgotten to say this to you. I ask guests what they think can contribute to living a good life and creating a good society. These big philosophical questions, but I just anything from your work and your thinking around conflict and your work on what it means to live a good life and to create a good society. Any thoughts at all?
Well, try not to demonize. Mm-hmm. Try not to, you know, put people in a box where they have been expelled from humanity. Obviously, in some cases, that's difficult to do. But, you know, there many others are placed in those boxes who don't necessarily, you know, who could be understood in a different way. General outlook on life. I mean, try to treat people well. Do your best to treat people well. That's all.
Neil, it's been really, really interesting. I've loved this conversation. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts and your wisdom, and we'll share this with a wide audience, I hope. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Simon. Great to talk to you.